Brian, how are you?
Charles, been too long.
Been way too long.
Yeah.
Man. So what have you been up to?
Well, I moved back over into the world of applications. I'm working in Bing, specifically in Bing Mobile, and we're doing some mapping-related stuff.
Okay.
And it's a lot of fun to be working on applications again instead of just pure technology.
Uh-huh.
Because there's nothing to prove or disprove your technology than actually putting it to work in a hardcore environment where there's real demands of scalability and performance.
Absolutely. Now, before you came here, I remember telling Niners that, hey, you know, Brian's working on a secret project. It's not secret anymore, so what were you doing?
Well, that was one of those, you know, not everything in life works out.
Okay.
So, but that was one of those things that didn't quite work out. But what I was working on was a pure functional programming language that was symbolic and numeric.
Mm.
So in other words, think of the marriage of Mathematica and Miranda. Miranda is the grandmother of Haskell.
Yep.
So if you think Haskell, Miranda is very, very close to it. Everyone knows that Mathematica does symbolic calculations as well as numeric calculations. So we had a reason to imagine that doing mixed symbolic numeric calculations in a pure functional style would be worthwhile. So we tried it, and it turned out, well, there's not that much demand for it.
But at least you did it.
I learned a lot of things from it. I learned a tremendous amount of things from it, and one of the things I learned was to love Link even more than I loved Link, because Link really is, if you want the pure functional feel on top of a language that also gives you access to procedure. I mean, sometimes, let's face it, you just want to poke some data.
Mm.
You just want to modify an array. You want to do some surgery on a tree. And there, if you're in the pure functional world, it's rocket science to do that.
Mm.
So you really want a mixed mode language where you can have pure functions when you want them for doing pure transformations, and that's Link. Dot select, dot where, dot aggregate. Beautiful. But on the other hand, when you want to just modify some data structures because you know what you're doing, and performance or scalability is a huge issue, and you can't afford to make a copy, even accidentally, then you want the access to the memory.
Okay.
And this, by the way, this holds for managed code as well as unmanaged code. Unmanaged code, of course, everything's wide open. You have complete access to the machine, whereas in managed code, you have access to the heap, to
sure.
objects and so on. It's still low-level access. The whole question boils down to mutability.
Mm.
Are your data structures immutable or not? If you're going to be absolutely pure, then your data structures have to be immutable. Your equations are equations. There's no such thing as an assignment.
Mm.
And this gives you a lot of logical purity to your code. It makes code easy to write and to think about and even to compile and to optimize.
Mm-hmm.
But certain things like modifying large-scale data structures are extraordinarily painful.
Understood. Now, Link is a monad, right?
Well, yeah, Link operates on monads.
Okay.
Yes. So the IEnumerable is a monad, IObservable is a monad, State is a monad, Maybe is a monad, the continuations are monads, and monads are just guys that support two operators, return, which is put something in the monad, and bind, which is take something, take a monad, take a thing, and make another monad.
Excellent.
So that's it. That's the whole story. Anything that fits into that, that's why monads are kind of everywhere, because a lot of things can be squeezed into that pattern.
Mm.
And I'll have some surprising things to tell you about later, some really big things.
Excellent.
Just a little bit further down. Just because I'm not working on that secret project anymore doesn't mean I'm not working on any secret projects.
Of course
I'm working on secret projects.
That's what they do.
But I have some interesting things to tell us.
Tell us. Show us.
What I want to talk about today is a hidden Markov model. A hidden Markov model is a model of some system that consists of a set of states. Now, you know what the possible states are, but you don't know what state the system is in at any time. The only thing you have access to is observations.
Mm.
So now I'm going to swing over to the whiteboard and show you. So we imagine that time is going this way. And the system, I'm going to draw a number of states like this just abstractly.
Okay.
With some number of states, And at any time, the system is in one of these states. So at another time, we have the same set of states. And let's do a few of them, a few times. So that's our world of states. And down here we have our world of observations, which I'll draw as little O's. So as time goes on, we receive observations as signals. Let me give you a specific example of this. The particular algorithm for hidden Markov models that I want to talk about is called the Viterbi algorithm, V-I-T-E-R-B-I. Mm. It's a classic algorithm. And I want to show you a particular implementation of it that uses Link.
Nice.
In an application of the Viterbi algorithm, we receive signals from this system that can be in any one of these states. Think of spelling correction. The set of states is the set of words in a dictionary. And the set of observations are the characters that somebody is typing on the keyboard. And what you're trying to figure out is what is the most probable state that the system is in, given that I have seen these observations. So the poor user is typing something like in sprung. And what the user is really typing is in the spring. Mm. But the user has made a number of typing mistakes. The Viterbi algorithm will let you figure out that this is what the most likely thing that the user was typing, given that the user typed this. These are the observations, the character I, M, space, J, H, E. And these are the estimates of the state of the sequence of states that Viterbi comes up with. I'm not going to show a spelling correction example of it, although that would be an interesting thing to do. Now instead I'm just going to talk about the algorithm a little more abstractly.
Okay.
The three inputs to Viterbi are, one, the initial probability distribution for the states. So state 1, this is usually written with a little pi. State 1 has probability pi 1 to the system has probability pi 1 to be in state 1 at time 0. So now I'm going to label the time 0, 1, 2, n. The system has probability pi 2 to be in state 2. So now I'm going to give these states little labels. S max. And pi 3 and pi S max and so on. Those are the initial probabilities. Another function is called the transition probabilities. Given that the system is in state I and that you've seen observation J, what is the probability that the system transitions from state I to any other state? So you can see that this transition probability can go from any state to any other state. So it's quadratic in the number of states, which is fine. That's by design. That's the way Viterbi works. And then one other thing that we have is given that the system is in state I, what is the probability that it emits observation J? So these are called the emission probabilities. And they're a function of the state S and the observation O. And the meaning is, if the system is in state S, what's the probability that it gives me observation O? And the transition probabilities takes you from, I'm now going to use just capital S for the type of states. State S1, state S2, and I sneak in the observation, although in most formulations of Viterbi, you don't actually put in the observation there, but I have some very good reasons for doing that in my application.
Okay.
So that's it. Actually, what I do in the particular code I want to show you is I sneak the observations into the states, but that's not, it's a refinement. So the meaning is, if I've already seen I n space, what's the probability of observing a J? It's pretty low. What's the probability of observing a T? Pretty high. So the emission probabilities are going to account for the fact that if we're in state I n space, probability of seeing a T is large, the probability of seeing a J is low, but it's non-zero. So that means we have to account for this probability, otherwise we can never correct the spelling mistake. So we're going to go back and the way Viterbi works is we're going to look backwards one step and say, given that I've seen this observation, what's the probability of the most probable path that got me to that observation? And what is that most probable path? We're going to compute both of them.
Okay.
So I hope that's clear.
It is clear. But, you know, again, it's interesting because, I mean,
this is deep technical stuff,
yeah.
But I'm actually going to make this really, really, really real because I'm going to show you the Wikipedia article.
Oh, of course.
And in my unit test, I'm going to recapitulate the Wikipedia article. So I'm either going to prove it right or wrong, and it turns out it's right.
Excellent. Cool.
Of course, the punchline to the entire joke.
Yes.
Did you not hear me say sequence of observations?
Yes.
Does this remind you of something? The reactive framework.
Oh.
Observations.
Beautiful.
So the innovation here is I've taken the classic Viterbi algorithm where there's no innovation there, and I've packaged it as an iObserver in the reactive framework.
Awesome.
So now if you have some stream of observations that's coming to you from an iObservable, all you do is walk up to that iObservable and subscribe your Viterbi to it, and out pops the states, out pops the spelling corrector.
Amazing.
Isn't that cool?
It's very, very cool.
So excellent. Now, we will go take a quick look at the Wikipedia article on the Viterbi algorithm.
Okay.
So here's the Viterbi algorithm. Dynamic programming, finding most likely sequence of hidden states, Markov information sources. Markov, in this context, Markov means I get to look back one.
Okay.
One transition. So there's lots and lots and lots, but the example here, and I'll have a time to go over these equations and explain what they mean, but the example here is pretty sweet. The two states are rainy and sunny. It's either rainy outside or it's sunny outside. The observations are, at any time, I think it's Bob, it's Alice and Bob, you know, the usual suspects in any kind of these things. Alice is observing Bob. Alice can observe Bob either walking, shopping, or cleaning. Now, the initial probabilities are 60% of the time it's rainy and 40% of the time it's sunny. So this is not Seattle. It would be 90-10 in Seattle.
Okay.
The transition probabilities are if it's rainy, then the probability that it will be rainy the next time is 70%. And the probability that it'll be sunny next time is 30%. If it's sunny, the probability that it'll be rainy next time is 40%, and the probability it'll be sunny next time is 60%. And the emission probabilities are if it's rainy, then the probability that Bob will be seen walking is 10%, shopping 40%, and cleaning 50%. And if it's sunny, then the probability is that Bob will be walking, that Bob will be observed walking is 60%, shopping 30, and cleaning 10%. These don't, in this particular example, this example is designed to be incredibly simple and straightforward. In the real world applications, and in fact in my code, which I am putting to work in Bing mobile mapping, these probabilities, they don't have to be constant. Even, and the set of states can be very, very large. The set of observations can be very, very large. There's lots of refinements that we can, but the basic algorithm stays the same. And this one is simple enough that you can do the calculations by hand. And so these are the this graphical representation is shows all the possible transitions. It's simply a graphical encoding of the thing that we just saw just above. And the algorithm here, this is one written in Python. I don't know, it's probably not as clear as the one that I've written in C sharp, so that's what I want to do is switch over to the one I've written in C sharp. As an observable observer pair. So the first thing I did, this is my unit test in the unit test framework, which I love, by the way.
Okay.
I love the unit test framework almost as much as I love LinkPad.
Nice.
I think LinkPad is just the coolest thing ever. Mm. It's the one program that if I had to say what's the one program that you wish you had written, it would be LinkPad. It's brilliantly conceived and executed. But the unit test framework is a close second because it almost allows you to script your tests. So there's a test class and there's a test method, and I'm just going to recapitulate the Wikipedia article. So there are my two states, rainy and sunny. There's my walk, shop, clean, my observations. And now I make an array of those states. I make an array of those observations. I encode these probabilities just right straight out of the paper. And then I do something new. And I hope if we have some time, I can show you this too, because in order to make this easy to code, I created a composable dictionary class. So I extended iDictionary so that you could just make a bunch of dotted calls to add unconditionally, and of course there's an add conditionally, to put stuff in your dictionary, and what you get back is another dictionary. Hmm. So my starting probabilities dictionary is going to be a mapping from states to probabilities.
Okay.
That's what a dictionary is, just a mapping from keys to values.
Okay.
So this is I'm going to construct this mapping by taking iDictionary. Notice this is the interface iDictionary. And the first time I call .addConditionally, it will behind the scenes make a dictionary for me and stick in there the key value pair rainy and the rainy probability. And then it will return a dictionary, so I can just on the next line do another .addUnconditionally. And I could keep going as long as I wanted, or I could do aggregates. Very nice way to make a streaming dictionary. And I hope, if we have time, I'll show you the implementation of that. Because that gets us into the state monad and the maybe monad and open source software and a whole bunch of topics.
Great.
That we can have a lot of fun with. So now this is the transition probabilities dictionary. This is a dictionary from states to dictionaries of states. In other words, it's quadratic on the number of states. For every state, I have a dictionary of states, and then the final target is a probability. So it's another way of looking at it is it's a function that takes two states and gives you a probability. It's a transition.
Okay.
And then finally, here's one that goes from state and observation to probability. And it's all done the same way with this composable dictionary. So we're still walking through the Wikipedia unit test. Now I'm going to try, just in case something happens, I'm going to create a function-based double Viterbi. The type of states is string, of observations is string, so we have the implementation of that thing on the right-hand side. The observations are strings, the states are strings, and the reason I say function-based is because the transition probabilities and the observation and the emission probabilities are going to be represented as functions in this version. I could have other ones, I could have dictionary-based, but I wanted to do it with functions. And the reason I say double here is it's often the case that you want to have a different kind of numeric type.
Mm-hmm.
In a Viterbi, you may want to have extended precision floating point, or you may just want to use a double precision. And I do not know a way to make my entire code generic on the numeric types, because the lowest level operators, plus, times, minus, and so on, they're not generic on the numeric types. Mm. Double plus double is double. There's no way to say plus that's generic on, You could do it. I suppose you could do it with operator overloads or something.
This could be.
But yeah. I don't know how to do it. And I spent a lot of time scavenging around trying to find a way to do it. And I just said, you know what? I'm just going to encode the underlying type right here.
Excellent.
So now this guy takes three functions. The constructor for the function-based double Viterbi takes three functions. A function from a state to a double, that's the starting probabilities. A function from a pair of states to a double, that's the transition probabilities. And a function from a state and an observation to a double, that's the emission probabilities. And here are my three functions as lambda expressions. Well, guess what? The starting probabilities are just the guy that indirects the dictionary that I was looking at. So in other words, I made dictionaries and then I made functions out of the dictionaries, just for convenience. Now here's where the magic happens. I take these observations. What am I doing here? I've got to remind myself what I'm doing in my own code. I zip the observation. Oh yes, that's right. The observables that I'm going to give to my function-based double Viterbi, the observables I'm going to give are in fact pairs of states and observations, because I need the probabilities, the transition probabilities sometimes depend upon the observations in my application. In general, they do not.
Can I interrupt you for one minute?
Absolutely, yes.
We're going to give people this code.
Oh yeah, this is open source.
So
this is out in the MIT license.
Excellent. So when we post this video, which is going to be soon,
yeah,
we'll give them...
I'll give you a GitHub address.
Excellent.
So here I'm going to take the set of states, and I'm just going to repeat it some number of times, and I'm just going to create a tuple out of the observation and the set of states. And I'm going to convert that into an observable. And now I'm going to take this obstates, and I'm going to dot subscribe my function-based Viterbi to it, and I'm going to get back out the final probabilities, and then I'm going to assert that they are equal within a rounding to the answers that the Wikipedia page has right there. Click, click. And I'm also going to look at the most probable state and assert that it's raining. This is my unit test. Let's run it and see what happens. Build. And it passed.
All right.
Okay, so that means we reproduced the Wikipedia article. Now let's look at the implementation of the Viterbi. It's not very long, and it's really, I'm quite impressed with the beauty of it, how nicely this came out. Okay, targets, this is inside the public class function-based double Viterbi. Parameterized on the type of observations and parameterized on the type of states. This is very general. I'm actually using it in a big, large-scale application with a continuous infinity of states, in fact. So it even works when the states are real numbers.
Nice.
The target states, that's an enumerable of states the system might transition to in response to an observation. So if we remember back on the board, this is one more over. We see an observation, what's the set of states it might transition to? So this is a key performance feature. I actually have to remove from these IE enumerables states where I know the probabilities are zero. Because these transition probabilities is quadratic in the number of states, and the performance of the algorithm overall is the number of states squared times the number of observations. A very expensive algorithm if the number of states are large. But I know a lot of them, the probabilities are so small that I'm just going to call them zero and remove them from this set of target states. So this set is of manageable size every time this thing is entered. The source states are the states the system might transition from to emit an observation. So that it's in a state, it emits an observation, and then transitions to another state. These are the three functions: starting probabilities, transition probabilities, and emission probabilities. Now, after the current observation is processed, I have a little thing here. This is a dictionary from states to double. And what this tracks, and we could just keep saying this over and over again, it's something you have to keep in mind when you're dealing with this algorithm. This is the probability of the most probable path that led to this state and observation. So that's what Viterbi tracks. Every time an observation comes in, it finds the probability of the most probable path and the most probable path, and it stores them. Next observation comes in, it updates those probabilities. So it's the probability of the most probable path and the most probable path itself. That's what it's keeping track of. So I get a list. I'm going to actually accumulate the entire history of probabilities of most probable paths that led to each observation and accumulate it in here. So that's a limitation on this implementation. This list grows.
Okay.
You could have another implementation that discards the old ones. This is just a property that exposes this list as an IEnumerable. Normally, I don't like to for users to have to know the underlying implementation of a data type. If IEnumerable is all you need to know, then that's all I'm going to tell you. So the backing store is a list for my convenience, and the visible property, notice there's no setter here, the visible property is an IEnumerable. There's somebody else in the hallway having a good time. The path is a dictionary from states to lists of states. So this records at every step in this trellis diagram, path here remembers for each state what's the path through the other states that led to that state. It's the most probable path through the set of states for the observations. So this one also grows over time. This list of S, every time you get an observation, you add something new to this path, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And as I say, in another implementation where you can't tolerate that, if you have millions of observations, you probably want to get rid of that amount of record keeping. Okay, so here's the whole function. This is the constructor. Pass in the probability functions, make sure they're not null and save them. And this is our implementation of iObserver. So we'll go back up here and look again and see that this guy implements iObserver of tuple of observation and set of states, or IEnumerable of states. Pretty cool, huh? Mm-hmm. Just what I showed you. You've got the observation, a little dark circle at the bottom, and you've got the list of states, or the IEnumerable of states. That's the thing that we're observing. So an iObserver has to have an onCompleted, an onError, and an onNext. onCompleted doesn't do anything. onError just rethrows. Here are a couple of little functions, helper functions. Now we get to the meat. lastV contains a mapping from state to the probability of the most probable paths to the state that was produced by the prior observation. So in other words, we've finished one and we remember for each state the probability of the most probable path that led to that state. We have to remember all the possible states because it might change. When we make a new observation, the most probable state after the new observation may be different than the most probable state at the old observation. Oops, he just typed a T. That means the word is the and not just something. So it shifts. So we have to remember the last one. onNext takes a tuple of an observation and a sequence of states that might have emitted this observation. So in other words, we're now looking at the next one. Here's the observation O, and here's the set of states that might have emitted that observation. And this is that state pruning that I was talking about. I have to pass this in every time I call onNext because I can't sit there and actually do work to calculate things that have zero probability. Okay. It's too expensive. So I prune the states. Every time onNext gets called, I get an observation and a pruned IEnumerable of states. And I call that value. And so we just remember from tuple that value.item2 is my list of states and value.item1 is my observation. A couple of contracts. Now, this implementation is self-bootstrapping. If the target states is null, That means this is bootstrapping. There have been no observations. This is the first time. There's no first set of states and observations. So I'm just now going to bootstrap the entire algorithm. So here's that. I'm going to create a new, I'm going to initialize score V. Remember, this contains the history of probabilities of most probable states. So it is a dictionary. It's a list or an enumerable of dictionaries from states to double. I'm going to initialize path. That's a dictionary from state to list of states. And here it's okay to expose list. My first V is one of these things inside this list score V. That's a dictionary from state to double. That's the first map from state to probability. And I'm just going to fill that up from the starting probabilities times the emission probability for a state and the observation. So in other words, I've received a stack of states and an observation. The first, for each state, the probability of the most probable path is the starting probability of that state times the probability that in that state I saw observation item 1. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that fills up my thing, and then the most probable path for each state at bootstrap time is simply the state itself. So the most probable path to the very first state is that state. The most probable path to that state is that state. There's nothing interesting happening first time around. Then, this will become clear in a second. I take the list of initial states and I assign it to target states. And I populate my list of dictionaries from states to probabilities, the probabilities of the most probable paths. And I switch first V into last V, and I return I'm out. That loads up my first stack. All other times, I have something in target states. I assign that to source states. In other words, last time through, the target states were over here. Those are now the source states for the next time through. The target states for this time through are whatever I received in my call of on next in the value. I'm going to make a next V, which is dictionary from state to probabilities. And now, we're almost done. Believe it or not, this thing is almost finished. For each target in the target state, I'm going to find from the source states. And here's an extension method that I made on IEnumerable. Because remember, states is an IEnumerable of states. I'm going to find the source state and the value of some lambda that gives me the maximum value of that lambda. So the argument of argnmax is a lambda that produces a value. And what argnmax will return is the state that produced the maximum value of that lambda and the maximum value of that lambda. So it's like max, but it remembers the input that gave you the max. So it returns both the input that gave you the max probability and the max probability itself. It returns an arg value pair, which I think, if I float over this thing, it will tell me the type, will it? And let's see. Right here, if I float over argnmax, we'll see that what it returns is an argument value pair. It's an extension method on IEnumerable that I created. So in this case, the argument value pair is a state and a double. This is going to return to me the source state that gives me the maximum probability of transitioning to the target state. For each target, I'm going to find the source state that gives me the maximum probability of transitioning to that target state and producing this observation. And the formula is very simple. This is the lambda that for every source state, now it's going to, we're doing for every target, we're going to look at every source. So this is the quadratic nature of the algorithm. For every target, up here, for every target, mm-hmm. I'm now going to look at every source because I'm now going to enumerate. This is an extension, argnmax is an extension on IEnumerable. I'm going to enumerate and apply this lambda to every source. So for each source, I'm going to do a few things. I'm going to look at the last V to that source. So now here I am over the source. That's the probability of the most probable path that led to that source. Got it. Now I'm going to do the transition probability from that source to that target. We're double looping here. And then I'm going to take the emission probability of that target and the observation that I see in the input to on next. Multiply them all up, and that's probability. So I magically get this, the state and probability of this. And I'll show you the implementation of this argonmax. I'm not very proud of it. It's something that needs to be cleaned up, but at least you see the idea. I was in a hurry when I wrote it. So now all we have to do is, here we are in the target set of states. We need to save the probability of the most probable path for every target, and that we get out of the return value from argonmax, and the value, just stuff it in there. The new path, well, for each target, we're going to copy the path that led to the source and then add the target to it. We have to copy it. We can't just add it because it could happen that we'll have multiple targets that have the same path to them. So we've got to make a copy. This is expensive. Notice it's for every target, it's copying the entire path, but that's is something you can get rid of if this implementation won't scale in your application. We just add the target to that new path and then assign that new path to the old path of target, and that causes garbage collection, or ultimately the old one will get garbage collected. And then we remember to add the probability of the most probable path, the dictionary of probabilities of most probable paths to the targets to underscore V, our backing store, and we switch next V into last V, and that's it. This thing is widely applicable.
Sure.
Anytime you have an observable and a set of states, you want to run a hidden Markov model. Now, I want to say that I have some ambitions behind this. I want to do all kinds of classical algorithms in this observable pattern. I want to do a Kalman filter. I want to do a particle filter. What this does is it lets the online and offline versions of your algorithm be the same. Normally in these implementations, the online is one version and the offline is another because they're executed in completely different ways. But the magic of Rx, you just write an observer. Mm. And you don't care whether the observations are static in memory or whether they're coming over some sort of streaming interface. You don't care. It's beautiful. Mm. Allows me to, instead of writing the algorithm two times, just write it once.
Awesome.
Okay. Couple more things then. I want to show the I want to show the dictionary and I want to show argonmax. So I have this thing called .NET extensions where there's kind of a Channel 9 story behind this. One of the Niners named Jordan Terrell approached me and said, I have some monads to show you. He has a thing called a maybe monad. I said, oh, I'd like to take a look. I looked at that, cool. And it was a very cool implementation. I said, why don't I add a state monad to this? So we actually collaborated here in the open source world. This is MIT licensed.
Awesome.
It's up on GitHub. It's a collaboration between Jordan Terrell's work and my work. And I will make sure that you have that GitHub address. I'll make sure it's all nice and clean before I do that. But kind of messy right now.
Make sure we get this by Christmas, though.
Yeah, absolutely. I will clean this all up for that. Okay, so here's public static class iDictionary, and this is how you add extension methods to something. I'm going to add some extension methods. And this makes dictionaries composable. That's the whole point of this thing. If you have just try get value, and then you have dictionary of key, square bracket key equals value that returns who knows what, that's doesn't return a dictionary, so you can't chain these things. Mm. So I came up with two APIs, add unconditionally, that will take the key-value pair and stick them in the dictionary, whether they're there or not. Mm. So it'll overwrite, if that key is already present in the dictionary, it will overwrite it. And then I added add conditionally. If the key is already in the dictionary, it won't overwrite it. Is there ever anything else you care about?
Mm.
I don't know, let me know. I'll add another one. So these guys, these extension methods on iDictionary, all they do is vector off to extension methods on dictionary. And in this case, if you don't provide me a dictionary. If you go idictionary.addUnconditionally, I will make you a new dictionary, and then I will add unconditionally the key value pair to the new dictionary. So let's look at the extension methods on dictionary. This is try get value stuck in the maybe moment. There's a lot going on here. I won't be able to go through all of this. Here is the version of add unconditionally that takes a dictionary. So if you have a dictionary, you go dictionary dot add unconditionally, and that will invoke this method. So I'm going to show you some three implementations of this. One is the straightforward implementation that is also admittedly the highest performance one. And I'll show you
the highest performance.
It's the highest performance. I went through the entire exercise of embedding this thing in our old pal, the state monad, where the dictionary is the state.
Okay.
It's kind of obvious, right? You want to just flow this state through the state monad. Beautiful code. It's slow. Sorry.
Why is it slow?
Because it's doing a lot of work. It's creating dictionaries. It's calling functions. It's shoving things through the monad.
So let me ask you one quick question at this point.
Doing a lot of work.
You know, and that actually brings this question up. I mean, what is it about? Why did you do this in C sharp and not F sharp? Would that have made a difference?
I doubt it would have made a difference.
Okay, because you have to do a lot of work to write monads in C sharp. Is
yes.
that true or false?
It is true. It
okay.
is true. The only reason I did it in C sharp is I'm much more familiar with C sharp. I have some acquaintance with F sharp, and every time I use it, I get a little bit better using it. This I write without thinking about it.
Rock and roll. Okay.
So here's the most straightforward implementation. If you were going to write this and you didn't know anything about the maybe monad or the state monad, this is how you'd write it. And so you can see I have a little conditional compilation on it. You're going to add unconditionally the key value pair, K and V, to the dictionary, the given dictionary. The given dictionary is called the dictionary, and the key value pair is called key value pair. So now what I'm going to do is, what am I doing here? I create a local variable named value that is default of type V. That's the type of the values. And I call the standard .NET method, dictionary method, tryGetValue, using the out parameter value and the key out of the key value pair. There's the key out of the key value pair. And I didn't actually need to do this at all. I can just take this right out of here.
Nice.
It's because I cut and paste this code from the conditionally part. Let's go look at the conditionally one. So there you got an example of cut and paste code, why you never do that. In the add conditionally version, I actually have to track the result of calling try get value. If it doesn't have the value, then put it in the dictionary. And that's what I wanted to do here. But back up to add unconditionally, I can just take this out. And in fact, I don't need that line either. Coding on the fly. And let's run our unit tests, make sure that everything still passes. And test add unconditionally, distance test, create, these are some other things, midpoint test, accumulate, tally test, and test x perf. Let's jump over to perf. And we can see I have some labels in here that are not strictly accurate here. But you get the point. The monadic unconditional dictionary perf is 1 millisecond to add 10,000 items.
Okay.
And doing things with just a for each loop, the non-monadic unconditional dictionary perf, is 0.757. But that's within the noise. They're comparable. If you look at the conditional one, it's 852 and 885.
Okay.
There's no penalty so far for making the dictionary composable.
And that's a good thing.
That is a good thing. Now, let's look at the cool code. Cool but slow. So I'll just switch the sense of my conditional compilations here, and I'll switch this one as well. We're going to go run through some monads. It looks like a lot of code, but it's actually, if you wrap your head around it somehow, you can see some deep beauty here. I'm going to return something. I'm going to return a transformation on the key value pair. What am I going to do with that? I'm going to convert the key value pair. I'm going to lift it into the state monad. You remember, let's hope, that the state monad is the monad of functions from state to pair of value and state. So it is, the state monad is the monad of functions that close over values, of closures over values. They thread the state through, and they present the value as the output. Mm. So every time you call the state monad, the call bind on the state monad, or actually every time you have an instance of the state monad, you have created a closure over the value. That's why it's doing so much work, is creating closures. There's a lot of other work it's doing too, as well. But look, the type of the state in my state monad is iDictionary. Mm. The type of the value is key value pair. What else could it be? Now I'm going to bind this. The same types here. Bind is select many. Select many takes three type parameters. It takes the source monad type, and in fact in the state monad, it takes the type of the state, the type of the value, and the type of the other value. So in other words, in this select many, I'm going to take an instance of a monad from state and key value pair to state and Boolean. And I'm going to so it's going to take a key value pair and return a Boolean. That's what try get value does. Mm. Interesting, huh?
Yes.
Yes. So that's what I'm doing here. Now I'm going to bind the function argument, the function that I'm going to bind, or select many, or shove, my older videos, I call it shove. I'm going to create a new state monad of iDictionary KV and Boolean. I don't even actually care what the Boolean is. But the propagator function in the state monad, remember the state monad is the monad of state to state value pairs. So this guy, this propagator, has to take a state, well that's a dictionary, and it has to return a state value pair. Well in C#, a pair is a tuple. It's going to, the state that it's going to, the value that it's going to return is the result of calling through the maybe monad to find out whether the key is in the dictionary, and then the dictionary itself. So remember, this propagator is a function from a state to a pair of a value and a state. You have to get the sense right. Value and state. State to value and state. The value is going to be Boolean. That's what that says. And the state is going to be the modified dictionary.
Okay.
Now, how am I going to calculate this value, which has to be a Boolean? So it's going to be the result is going to be has value. This is where we entered Jordan Terrell's code, and I won't go through that code. You'll just have to work that on your own. But it's the standard maybe monad. Jordan has an incredible implementation of the maybe monad here. I'll just show you this thing. He's got a whole. This is a link provider on top of the maybe monad. If you want to learn how to write a link provider, here's how you do it. This is a full link.
Check out Jordan's code.
Yeah, check out Jordan's code.
Maybe monad.
Yes.
Whoops. Now all of that code eventually returns yes or no.
It's going to return a Boolean, and in fact, I'm going to throw the Boolean away because this is add unconditionally. So I don't actually care whether the thing is in the dictionary or not. Mm-hmm. Remember, I had that mistake up there where I was actually checking whether it's in the dictionary. I don't actually care. So in this case, I'm going to find out whether the key was already in the dictionary, and then I'm going to throw it away. And the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to try get value on the key, and I'm going to, these are operators that Jordan provided, dot on no value, add the key to the dictionary. On value, do the same thing. So no matter which way it goes, I'm going to put the thing in the dictionary. And I used two different standard dictionary APIs. In this one, I use dict.add, and in this one, I use dict with the indexer syntax. I think they would both work in this circumstance. Actually, we can try that. I don't remember offhand whether that works here. Coding on the fly here, real-time coding. We love that. Did I get everything right? Yeah, let's try the run unit tests. Love my unit tests. Come on. Yay! They all passed. So that syntax also works for adding it, but I want to keep the old syntax because this code is art code.
It's art code.
This is art code. You want the perf code, you put that other thing up there too. And I'll prove it to you.
By looking at the
perf numbers, I'll say, maybe not so much.
Well, it looks like there's a lot more computation here.
Yeah, right? See, this is 200 milliseconds to insert 10,000 items using the composition of the maybe monad and the state monad. Nice. Nice to have these tools lying around. Maybe this isn't where you want to use them.
Now, could you argue that maybe the implementations need to be optimized? Or is it just the fact that the cost of being monadic?
I think in this case it's the cost of being monadic.
Okay.
Certainly, almost any code can be optimized further.
Sure.
I cannot see an easy way to optimize this a lot further. Maybe I would inline it, maybe I would unroll it. If you're going to do all of that, you might as well just jump to the high performance.
But at the end of the story, the high performance is still composable.
Yeah.
So it's a win-win.
This is just the implementation of the streaming diction. It's a win-win. So I get to have my art, I get to have my cake and eat it too.
Excellent.
I get to say, look, logically speaking, there is a state monad in here and there's a maybe monad in here. But I don't actually have to use the code for those things. I'll just shove things in the dictionary and be done with it. So this is actually where... this is actually a good lesson in pure functional programming versus practical programming. This is pure functional. I could write this in Haskell. Mm. This is pure functional. This is the state monad and the maybe monad, and there's no fooling around in here. The dictionary, the rocket science in Haskell would be in the dictionary. How do you make an immutable dictionary? Not so easy. Yeah, there are ways to do it. I probably would use the array class or something like that. There's this pseudo-mutable array class in Haskell. I call it pseudo-mutable in the sense that you can't write a program that detects that you have mutated the array, but underneath the covers it does actually mutate it. It's probably what I would do.
Now, mutation is a side effect.
Mutation is a side effect, yeah.
So one of the things having spent a fair amount of time with... Simon Peyton Jones recently. And I think he's brainwashed me.
Yeah.
And that's just because, like you can sit and watch them and like everything they say makes sense. So my quick question there is, I thought the way around or the way to add side effectual behavior to a pure functional language is
monad. Yes. So actually what I would do is inside here I would have the state monad and the maybe monad.
Yes.
And then these pseudo-mutable arrays are another monad.
So everything that were the side...
It has to be.
It's just a chaining of monads.
Yes, it has to be. There's no... So the surface of that pseudo-mutable... The only reason I brought it up is because they've done a lot of work on the perf of these things. So the interface is purely monadic, and there's no way you can tell that any mutation is going on. You can't write a program that can tell.
Okay.
Because you modify it through the monad. Mm. But... If you do it in a straightforward way, if you just write it as a dictionary, then you're making copies every time you're adding something. You take the old dictionary, add an item. What that really means is that you've copied the old dictionary and appended an item. Think of doing it on a list. Mm-hmm. All you can do is con something onto the beginning of a list.
I have your new million-dollar plan.
Uh-oh.
Monads as a service.
Ooh. Yeah, that's right.
Side effects?
Come on. Azure. Come on. Yeah. A web service for monadic monadic operations in Azure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hey,
why not?
Need purity, but side effects.
Yeah.
And composability.
Yeah.
And, I like art. So give me a big monadic tree. Yeah. Send it down to me via web server. Blah, blah.
Hey.
I'm just kidding.
No, no.
It sounds
you're
cool,
not
though.
Kidding. We could actually do that.
All right. So.
So anyway, this is an object lesson in the difference between artful code that actually shows the logic of what's going on, the underlying real algebra. So this is the difference between the functional bigots and the imperative bigots. And I use that word lightly,
bigots. I mean
in a sense of humor, humorously. But people who want to see everything I would call this the real stuff that's going on. The monadic stuff. That's the real algebraic structure. That's the mathematical structure of the program that we've just written here. Mm. That's the heavenly truth. But when we come down to Earth and have to have some speed, yeah, we do it this way. We just poke values in the dictionary and have a nice day. Thank you. We get rid of that distraction. But outside of this composable dictionary, you can't tell which you've done. So in essence, this is how these high-performance data structures work inside Haskell as well. Mm. Outside the interface, you can't tell what's happened. Okay, so that's it. There's a lot more going on here. Play with it.
And so now to kind of wrap it up, bring us back to the beginning. So you've used this algorithm.
Yes.
That's typically used to...
do spelling correction. In fact, let me invite the Niners to actually use this code to create a spelling corrector.
Nice.
All right.
Excellent.
I'm using it in secret applications, but I'll give
I'll give you
a taste.
Okay.
I'll give you a taste. You know that a dashboard GPS item, dashboard GPS unit.
Yeah.
When you're driving around and emitting GPS, it knows where you are on the map. Mm-hmm. So imagine that we were receiving GPS and we needed to help you. We wanted to write a little GPS. A simulation of a dashboard GPS unit. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't this be a good way to do it?
Yes.
The GPS is like a noisy signal about where you are, and the road network is a...
The words.
It's the state.
It's the state.
So the little GPS that you're wandering around... By the way, this is something that John Crum has published out of MSR some time ago.
Okay.
So you could... There's nothing secret here.
Sure.
The use of the Viterbi algorithm for this application is well known. Mm-hmm. It's probably best of breed, at least in the research community. What actual GPS dashboard units do behind the scenes, they don't really talk that much about. The literature on this problem is pretty sparse.
So isn't it, like, I mean, in some sense, isn't it mainly I'm driving around and every millisecond the actual GPS coordinates are being calculated,
yeah,
or being actually requested from a satellite,
yes,
or requested from something sending signals from somewhere.
Yeah.
Then triangulation, you know, blah blah blah, that kind of simple thing that we understand how GPS works.
Right.
Whereas what you're talking about is more along the lines of what street am I on? What street do I have
given
to go on?
GPS.
Given that
given the GPS, where am I? Given the GPS, where am I? And the GPS is very noisy. If you look at actual GPS trail on a map, it looks like a drunken sailor walking around and bouncing into buildings and stuff. So it's ideal for a spelling corrector. The words that you're trying to spell are the streets that you're actually driving on.
Okay.
And the noise that you're pounding into the keyboard are the actual GPS units that you're spitting.
But what keyboard?
Well, it's a virtual. It's not really a keyboard.
It's data.
This is an analogy. Yeah.
Got it.
The noisy signals that you're getting are the GPS, the drunken walk down the streets.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So, but I'd rather see an actual spelling corrector. I'd rather see Niners cook up a spelling corrector. Yeah,
totally.
Because this GPS thing, this GPS map matching thing, actually has an annoying number of subtleties. And
now let me say
the names of those two researchers again. John Crum, K-R-U-M-M.
Okay.
He's in MSR, and he wrote a paper on an application of Viterbi to this problem with Julie Lechner. Lechner. That's great paper to go look up.
Okay, we'll get that on the description of this video.
Super.
Now, we can't ever come and talk to you without at least spending 5 minutes on physics.
Okay. All right. Good.
Okay. So a lot of what's going on in the news is this notion of the Higgs boson.
Right.
This mythical superparticle,
yeah,
or whatever the hell it is,
yes,
quantum mythical particle,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
and that if it gets discovered in the world's most expensive, giant machine,
yeah,
it's like ridiculous. You know, okay, let's hope they don't make a black hole and we all get
screwed. That thing is a giant ray gun, by the way.
Okay, I wanted to ask you a couple. Giant circular ray gun.
Yeah, that's what I.
Now, what does it mean, in your opinion, if they discover this thing?
Okay, this is easy. One of the first times I met Richard Feynman, I don't know, I was probably 9 or 10 years old, and he came in to give a guest lecture at a math camp. And I gave a nice talk about the elementary particles, and I raised my hand and I said, how can I calculate the masses of the elementary particles from first principles? You know, I have pi and e, and I know these numbers. And, you know, maybe it's pi squared over 4 plus 16 or whatever. How can I do that? And being Richard Feynman, he says, ah, if you answer that, you will get the Nobel Prize in Physics for sure. So the Higgs boson arises from the attempt to calculate the masses of the elementary particles from first-er principles. The masses of elementary particles are just observed facts. They just are there. And there's no rhyme or reason. Why does a proton weigh so much? Why does a lambda particle weigh so much? A psi, whatever. They just observe these things in the laboratory and they weigh them. The standard model of elementary particle physics, though, gives you a way to calculate those masses from things called coupling constants. And in other words, from things that are more primitive. Mm. And the Higgs boson arises as part of this theory, as part of a thing called a phase transition or symmetry breaking. Not an expert in this area, but I know roughly how it works. If they find the Higgs boson and they weigh it, and it weighs approximately what they think it's going to weigh, then this series of masses of the other elementary particles will fall into line and make much better sense. That's the meaning of it.
Okay.
It gives you a much more satisfying theory for understanding the masses of the elementary particles, which otherwise are just strange, bald facts, which is annoying to people, right? And actually, I misstated before. I think the, and again, I'm at risk of exposing my lack of expertise here. I think the actual values of the coupling constants will fall out of this, out of these computations as well.
Well, your expertise is cosmology.
That was
astrophysics.
That's what I did my thesis on. Yeah.
Right on.
But part of the, I'm not a string theorist or anything like that. But I have a kind of a educated physicist's view on it. But the exact calculations and things like that, I don't know how to do them. It's a heavy industry. Spend years and years and years trying to figure out how to do these things.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Brian, for spending this much time with us. I think
thank you.
Everybody's going to be very happy to see you again. Niners, please play around with this algorithm, and you're going to have the code in your hand.
You bet.
You're going to get to see the art and also the practice, or the practical versus the artistic.
Artistic, right.
And thanks, Brian, and happy holidays to everybody out there.
Yes, happy holidays to all of you, and see you next time.
Absolutely. And hopefully it'll be sooner than later.
I have lots of new things to show.
Right on, man. Take care, Brian.
Cheerio.